For the week of January 12th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 220, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, Michael, let me ask you something. Do you ever have anybody come up to you in the street or friends or family and ask you, hey, Showbiz Sandbox, what's that about again?
No, if I bring it up, they usually their eyes glaze over.
Oh, really? Okay, well, you know.
My family doesn't read my stories. They don't go to my website. They don't listen to my podcast. They do nothing.
Well, you know, if they did listen to the podcast, Showbiz Sandbox, that is, they would actually not have to read any of your stories because we distill all of the stories that you're covering and that other entertainment journalists are covering, and we boil it all down for our listeners so that they know all of the top entertainment news from the past week.
And if they want to subscribe, what do they do?
Well, funny you should ask. I have that right here. You can subscribe in iTunes and Stitcher, in the Microsoft Marketplace, anywhere they give podcasts away for free because we don't charge you anything. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook. Showbiz Sandbox is the page you can look up. That's facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. Or 888-567-7263. Of course, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com.
And of course, if they're listening this week, what are they going to hear about? What exactly are we going to talk about on this show?
Well, again, we're going to distill all...
No, specifically.
Oh, specifically. Well, we've got the perfect fix for your Golden Globes hangover. And what I mean by that is we'll be giving you a rundown of last night's big winners and bungled speeches, as well as review some nominees being announced for related awards groups like the DGA.
I would think the best fix for a Golden Globes hangover is to not talk about the Golden Globes.
Well, yes, but then we'd have no job.
Oh, okay.
Now, meanwhile, broadcasters will finally get their day in court. Their lawsuit against Aereo, the cord-cutting over-the-air enabler, is headed to the Supreme Court. We'll finish with some additional insight into 4K, specifically the dirty little secret about whether content providers can actually afford to deliver it to you on your new Ultra HD television sets. That will lead us into a related listener email from James Gardner out of Australia. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire, except for his family, Michael Giltz. He's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're talking about the weekend box office around the world. The number one movie is Frozen, another $42 million. It's at $712 million worldwide. It continues to break through in North America, setting records for a Disney Pixar animated film. It's rising up the charts on Disney as one of their top grossing films of all time, at $317 million in North America, almost $400 million internationally, and it's still going strong. It has the number one soundtrack in the country. It was at number three or four last week. This week, it's number one. Of course,
it's actually number one on the Billboard charts, the number one album, period.
That's what I just said.
But you said on the soundtrack charts.
Maybe they have a soundtrack chart. I didn't mean to imply. It's number one on Billboard.
Okay.
Top 200.
All
yeah.
Right.
We're vehemently agreeing.
Say,
I mean, okay. It's the number one soundtrack, but it's number one album. Yes.
Okay.
Thanks for correcting that. So it's a big hit. At number two around the world is Lone Survivor, the soldiers on a mission movie starring Mark Wahlberg, $39 million worldwide. That includes just a tiny little bit overseas. It's basically all domestic here in North America, where it was the number one film over the weekend and a solid opening for that movie, which also stars, what's his name? Taylor Kitsch from Friday Night Lights. He has worked with director Peter Berg on, of course, Friday Night Lights to a degree.
As Battleship. Far
as that was where he got his big break. And Battleship, which was sort of a disaster for them. So it's nice that they're back together and making a successful film, both commercially and to a degree critically. At number three around the world is The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, another $30 million. It passed the $800 million mark worldwide. At number four, Paranormal Activity, The Chosen, The Mark of the Chosen. What's it called?
I thought it was called Paranormal Actividad.
Paranormal Actividad. That's
yes.
Right. This is the Latino Hispanic spinoff of the Paranormal Activity franchise. I forget what the subtitle of it is, but it made $21 million. It's at $63 million worldwide. I don't care what the marketing budget was. It wasn't that big. So for a movie that costs $5 million to make, it's well into the black. And we're sure to see a sequel to this spinoff. At number five around the world is The Wolf of Wall Street, the Martin Scorsese film, $19 million, which helps it pass the $100 million mark worldwide. At number six, the Ben Stiller film, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, another $18 million. That's at $145 million worldwide. It's pretty much doubled what it made domestically overseas, and it's not done yet, so we'll have to see where this ends up. At number seven, Despicable Me 2. It opened up in some more new territories, two to be exact, made another $13 million. It's at $935 million worldwide. It opened in China, didn't it? Or am I wrong? Yes, it did. It opened in China. A huge opening for an animated film, especially since Despicable Me 1 didn't even open in that country. So this was, in a sense, brand new to them, though they all probably saw it on bootleg. But $935 million worldwide for an animated film, that is huge.
In fact, I would go so far as to say it just goes to show you how much piracy played in China and in many Asian territories.
Perhaps. So you could also just say there was a pent-up demand to see the movie. Since they were cheated out of seeing the first one, they were excited to see the second.
But how would they know what was going on?
Well, it's not hard.
I know.
It's despicable me. At number eight is American Hustle, which might be a little more confusing for people overseas to follow since it's all about abscam, a scandal here in American politics in the 70s, I believe.
1978 to 82.
Yeah. That grossed $13 million. It's at $127 million worldwide. And, of course, was one of the big winners at the Golden Globes. And number nine is 47 Ronin, the Keanu Reeves film, another $11 million. It, too, passed the $100 million mark. At number 10, The Legend of Hercules.
I'm sorry, Michael. What are you talking about? I don't know anything about this movie. You must have some wrong information here because The Legend of Hercules is not even a movie.
It is. At number 10, it's called The Legend of Hercules, right? Where did it open in North America? It opened at number four, which is where it made almost all its money. Why, I wonder. There are all these deities and all these people. People have told a million stories over and over and over again. Robin Hood, King Arthur, Hercules, Thor, on and on. Why do the Hercules movies always suck? Like, they've never made a good movie about Hercules. Is it something about demigods? I don't get it.
I have no idea.
It's been a cheesy franchise from day one. You know, they've had a dozens of versions of the story of Hercules, and this one is no good, better than any of the others. Pretty weak opening. I'm not sure what the budget was on this. It seemed like it was a pretty decent budget. Not a huge budget, but a decent budget.
Wait, you saw the movie?
Oh, God, no. I didn't see it.
$70 million. $70 million reported budget.
Did I say I saw it?
No, but you said it seemed like it was...
Oh, well, I mean, from the ads, it looked like a decent, you know, it looked like they'd spent some money. So, yeah, $70 million is a decent budget. And for some reason, Hercules is cursed. I don't know. Maybe Zeus has just put a hex on him or something and said, no, thou shalt never have a good film franchise.
I see what you did there. You kind of did. You Greeked it up, if you will.
That's right. At number 11 is Anchorman 2, another $9 million. That's at $158 million worldwide. Kind of cute because I was looking at the Golden Globes coverage, and at the bottom it said something about the disappointment of Anchorman 2, and I clicked on it to see what the related story was. It was the weekend box office when the movie opened, and they said, hey, look at this. All the people in Anchorman are much bigger stars now, including Steve Carell and, you know, Paul Rudd. And, you know, they had all this big buildup and all these marketing tie-ins. Why didn't this movie open bigger? Why is it such a disaster? Well, that's because you got to wait until all the money's in. Anchorman 2 has been steadily chugging along in North America. It's doing decently well overseas. It's at $160 million. So this is a movie that's going to prove very profitable and is done better than the original. That's all you can ask for from a sequel. At number 12,
adjusted for inflation. Just kidding.
It's only a few years. At number 12 is August Osage County, the film whose marketing plan Sperling takes issue with. It made $9 million in its expansion. It's at $13 million total. Most of that in North America, but some of that made in other parts of the world. It expanded to 900 screens. It has an 8,000 per screen average.
No, I don't have a problem with the marketing campaign. I have a problem with
the... You said they should have opened up wide on opening weekend. They distributed poorly.
I said I have no idea when it's being released. Their awards campaigning is not very good. That's what I said.
No, you said they should not have opened it in a limited release. It should have opened wide. Do you now retract that, or do you not remember that?
Well, no, you said it's not getting very good reviews. And I said, well, then in that case, the way to open is to just do a marketing blitz and you open in one weekend.
But August Osage County is the last movie in the world you should do a 3,000 screen opening weekend blitz on. It's not that type of movie. It's for older audiences. It can get good word of mouth, even if critics don't like it. It is getting some awards attention, but it's obviously not getting the good reviews that the play did. But nonetheless, it's just not a good idea. And you know what? They opened on 900 screens, right? And they made $8,000 per screen. So they made about $7 million in North America. In contrast, Her, which has glorious reviews and is, to my mind, easily one of the two or three best films of the year.
It's an amazing movie. Go see it immediately. I can't recommend the movie enough.
It's a really special, odd, lovely little film. It opened expanding onto 1,700 screens, about twice the number of screens of August, but it only made $5,000 per screen. Right. Yeah. So now, to my point, not only did they open up too wide too soon, since obviously this movie desperately needs word of mouth because it has great reviews, but it's an odd film. And you say it's about a guy who falls in love with his operating system, or basically Siri. People go, what? So it does benefit a lot from word of mouth. And the fact that they opened it on 1,700 screens means everyone who went to this movie, the theaters were half empty. You know, there were twice as many people in each theater where August Osage County was playing.
Well, that's, you know.
And that really affects the experience of people who go to a movie. I really strongly feel that they might have made the same amount of money on half the screens, or maybe on 500 screens. Maybe they would have made a little bit less, but the people who went would have had a better time and told their friends, hey, this movie was good. You know, when the theater's more crowded, you have more fun. And I think they really undervalue that. They're so excited about expanding on as many screens as possible. They forget what kind of a time are people having when they go to the movie.
Well, I would say that's if you look at the averages, because certainly there may have been some theaters where nobody showed up, literally nobody, and other theaters where it was packed and it was sold out. So it really, if you look at averages, yes, that theory holds.
Well, Sperling, it's not like suddenly people in one area said, we're not going to go to that movie at all. And people in other, I mean, people generally, I'm sure there were regional differences, and I'm sure there were, you know, movies that play better in the suburbs or in the heartland that don't play as well in the big city and the reverse. But I think by and large that you're not finding a radical change where like one theater is empty and other theaters are jammed full with people cheering with joy. You know, I think obviously there's some difference in different areas for as far as how movies play. But by and large, the audience that's going to go to these movies is going to go. But if it's on twice as many screenings, that just means there's more options. And so you're splitting up your audience. So the 400 people that would go to see Her ended up with eight different times to choose from instead of, say, four different times. And therefore, they went to theaters that were half as empty as they might have been if they'd had fewer screenings to choose from. And if you got more people to go to a screening together, they'd have a better time. I really think that's true, don't you?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, sometimes I'm actually happy that there's nobody in the theater. When I saw Desolation of Smaug, you know, the movie was so long that I had to go to the bathroom halfway through, and I was glad I didn't have to trip over 500 people on the way out.
I'm just saying, if Her had opened on 500 screens and they made the exact same amount of money, $5.4 million, they say they made the same amount of money, the same people wanted to go and were able to go, basically, even though it was on fewer screens, fewer running times, I bet the people that went would have had a better time and passed on word of mouth that was more positive to their friends. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
13, The Hunger Games: Catching Fire. Another $8.8 million. It's at $846 million worldwide. It is now the highest grossing film that was released in 2013. It's not the movie that grossed the most in that year, in that calendar year, but of all the movies that were released initially in 2013, it is the highest grossing. It passed Iron Man 3 to become, now that can't be true. That's in North America.
Yes, that is only in North America. And what I love is all the qualifiers Lionsgate had to put on that. You know, that Iron Man 3, yes, was released in 2013. Catching Fire was released in 2013.
Made some of its money in 2014, and it's only domestic, not international.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's at $409.4 million in North America and puts it 13th on the list of highest grossing films of all time, without, of course, adjusting for inflation. But still, a very impressive run for the Catching Fire quadrilogy. What do you call it? Four films.
I don't know. It's a series.
The Hunger Games quartet.
Yes. I don't know.
And number 14 is Walking with Dinosaurs, $7.6 million. It's just about to pass the $100 million mark worldwide. Some international films that haven't made it yet to North America that we've been talking about. The Attorney, another $6 million. That's at $63 million and counting. The Physician, another $6 million. That's at $38 million and counting. And then Saving Mr. Banks, which also made another $6 million. That's at $78 million worldwide. And Ender's Game, we almost forgot about it, but it's back up in 11 territories. It grows $6 million, and it's about to pass the $90 million mark. Poor Ender's Game, the franchise that wasn't to be.
Yeah, well, you know, if you read the books, I guess it's a franchise, but frankly, the first book is the one that everybody talks about, so I'm not so sure that we're missing anything.
Oh, absolutely not. Certainly not critically or commercially. But, you know, the worldwide box office is growing, but not for every country.
That's right. In the UK, the United Kingdom, the box office actually shrank in 2013. It's the first decline in 10 years. In 2005 and 2006, there were kind of zero-sum games. They didn't really lose anything. They didn't gain anything, which in a way, given inflation, is losing something, but that's another story. So really, this is the first time. And it didn't decline that much, did it?
No, it fell 1%, and here's my point. I imagine 2012 was probably the highest grossing year of all time in the UK.
Well, it wasn't,
so
but
when you
had...
say, oh, it didn't top the one of the all-time grossing years or one of the two or three highest grossing years in UK film box office history. It's a disaster. Box office is declining. No, that's perfectly normal. You can't expect to increase in a particular country every single year when you're in a mature market like the UK. If it's a new market like India, where you're expanding the screens and more people are being able to afford to go to the movies and they have more chances to do so, yes, you can expect growth year after year after year for a while. But the UK, that's ridiculous.
Well,
it's a perfectly natural up and down.
I like their excuses or their reasoning for this. There was no James Bond film in 2013. Okay, fair enough. There was no Harry Potter film in 2013. Also fair enough. But then I love the other reasoning is a summer of mostly pleasant weather was also being blamed.
Well, that's pretty notable for the UK.
Exactly. Now, I guess, so that's the UK. And what I also found interesting was that, what did they pull in? $1.92 billion in US dollars, which is 1.17 billion pounds.
Wow, we didn't need a conversion, but thank you.
Okay. Well, you know, just for our UK listeners, in case they were wondering how much that was. And that's actually 6% of the global box office. I did not know that. But then you kind of cross the channel, if you will, and you go to the Netherlands. And the Dutch box office makes...
They're across the channel?
Well...
I guess technically, yeah.
Yeah, into the mainland, onto the continent, if you will.
Okay. I mean, France is across the channel.
You know what
I
mean.
I'm no geographer, but I'm no Amerigo Vespucci, but sorry, whatever.
I can't even pronounce that.
Clearly, I can't either. So the Dutch are doing well at the box office.
But what I love is that $340 million is their entire box office take in 2013, and that includes...
That's big!
Yeah, that includes 20% of the local fare that did well in the Netherlands.
Well, I mean, so their local film production is only 20% of the box office. Perhaps not so surprising, since it's a small country, so they probably don't have the wherewithal to make a ton of movies.
Right.
Right, so you wouldn't necessarily, you know, not every country is going to, you know, produce a huge amount of films. You know, either it's a small country, really small country, so it just doesn't have the infrastructure or the money to do it, because movies are pretty expensive. So it's not the worst thing. But there's only 16 million people in the Netherlands, for God's sake.
I know.
So I mean, $340 million, that's pretty darn good.
Yeah, well, and as far as infrastructure goes, the Netherlands is quite good. They have a lot of cultural...
So it's very mature. They've got a lot of screens.
And they really support filmmaking and the arts, and they have lots of cinematic institutes. So I think, they're up 0.8%. The UK's down 1%. So it's a wash in a way.
Yeah.
But now let's talk about something. And actually, I can tell you at least 5, 6, 7 people sent in emails within an hour of this being made public. And this is the Digital Entertainment... I can't remember the group. The Digital Entertainment Group is the name of the group. And they made public the 2013 revenue from home video. And instantly, 7 people emailed dirt@showbizsandbox.com with this information. So thank you, all of you. I guess they heard us last week talking about whether video sales had increased or decreased. I guess they went up barely.
I mean, the news coverage I've seen of it doesn't break it out very well. Have we got better breakdowns of actually what Blu-ray made and what these others made? They said basically the big news, the big headline was digital sales. That means, you know, digital downloads of movies and TV shows surpassed $1 billion for the first time. Surpassed it quite handily. It was like $1.2 billion, right?
Yes.
Something like that. And so that's if you bought a digital download of a movie or a TV show, that was adding to that kitty, that pile. It's over $1 billion. You figure the domestic is about $18 billion. That's what it was in 2012. So it's probably going to be at least that in 2013. So that's, you know, it's not even 10%, but it's still starting to become a very significant factor in how much money they're making.
I mean, everybody is selling video digitally. You have Apple with iTunes and Walmart stores with Vudu, and Target has their own, and Comcast has.
Well, it went up like almost 50%.
Right. So
I mean, it's a huge, and why? Because people have tablets. It's easy to buy a movie or a TV show now, and easy to watch it in a way you want to.
That's
right. I mean, it used to be if you bought it, then you had to somehow get it to your TV or whatever. Now people are just buying the thing and they're letting their kids watch, an episode of a TV show while they're in the car or on an airplane or just in the backyard, you know. So it's so much easier now to do it. So, of course, people are going to do it. Make it easy, they'll do it. That's why iTunes worked, even though people could steal music. They made it easy. They made it relatively inexpensive, and people were happy to take it.
I've actually seen parents pushing their toddlers in the grocery store, the toddler sitting in that little, toddler basket up front, watching video on the iPhone. And I just thought, what is the world coming to?
I mean, come on, you know, it's like they're probably, if they're a toddler, they're probably too young to be consuming television that much, right?
Let's
criticize their parenting.
Yes. Immediately. You know, hell is other parents, or is it other people's kids? I think it's both, actually. But
so they have some other breakdowns, but I'm not clear what they mean. They say disc sales declined 8%.
They do not break down. The Digital Entertainment Group is the group, the kind of, it's the NATO, if you will, the National Association of Theater Owners, for home video here in the United States. So we're only talking about North American grosses here. So I should point that out.
Thank you. And so they did say that total box office, home entertainment spending, including DVDs, Blu-rays, streaming, digital downloads. I assume this does not include revenue from subscriptions, or does it?
It does, actually.
It does. Okay, yes. That's odd. So that total is $18.2 billion, which is slightly up over last year, which was about $18 billion in the home. Compare that to the box office, which is $10 billion. You can see how important the home is. For studios, that's where most of their money comes from.
Yeah, you know, so you had disc sales, Blu-ray and DVD dropping 8%. I was surprised 72 million U.S. homes have Blu-ray compatible devices.
That's about 120 million homes, 130 million homes. How many homes are there? I forget.
I have no idea, but a majority of them have Blu-ray compatible devices, that's for sure.
Well, I'm not surprised. Now if you had to replace your DVD player, you're going to go buy a Blu-ray. It's $80, so, you know, why wouldn't you?
Right. Well, also, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy because it's hard to buy a DVD player these days. You have to buy a Blu-ray player, but they all play DVDs, so it doesn't really matter. Now, you know, this electronic or digital video is so important because you do have disc sales dropping 8%. You do have video rental down 14%, but of course, Blockbuster closed for good this past year. Kiosks, so Redboxes, also declined 1% to $1.9 billion. And the rentals were $1 billion. However, so now you're making it up not only on digital video sales, but also in streaming-based subscriptions, which rose a whopping, as it said here in the LA Times, 32% to nearly $3.2 billion in 23. Of course, we all know who benefited most from that. It was Netflix.
Surely they'll just renegotiate the deals. I mean, I don't understand. Why would they let Netflix get all the profit? Netflix is nothing without them. So more and more of the money is going to the studios. I mean, we've seen when Netflix has to renegotiate or re-sign a deal with people, it's getting to be big money.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. So, I mean, I don't get that. Oh, it's all going to Netflix.
Well, we also know
more and more of it's going, as the bigger and more successful Netflix gets, the more Warner Brothers is going to demand for their movies.
And the biggest deal being $300 and some odd million for the Disney, Netflix purchasing Disney. So that was the biggest deal that we know of today.
And again, people have, they have their PS3 or their Xbox One or PS4 now, I should say. They've got their tablet. So it's easier to access things like Netflix.
Yes.
And, Amazon Prime than ever before, so it's worth paying for.
Right, I agree.
There are about 125 million homes in North America. I should say in the U.S., so that does not include Canada, actually, now that I think about it. So I don't know how many homes extra there are in Canada, but if we're talking about the North American market, as I guess we are, that must be even bigger.
Well, between streaming going up and digital video sales going up, I mean, you also had,
the whole pie we see is bigger this year than last year. What was the peak year for home entertainment? I don't know what the biggest year.
I think it was 2004 in the midst of the big DVD boom.
Well, that's the end, the tail end, surely.
Yes, exactly. And it started to decline. But hey, look, it's going in the right direction.
Was it like $25 billion or what was it?
I think it was like $19 billion.
That's it?
Yeah, I don't quote me, but I'd have to go back and look. But VOD is, look, at the end of the day, it's better than declining. That's all I have to say.
Well, yeah, but it's not even close. I mean, they're doing great.
Yeah, well, and what do you think about this analyst saying that VOD prices will actually go up this year by about a dollar, that studios are going to try and offset DVD declines by you know, charging a dollar more for video on demand?
Video on demand means you're on your cable TV and you get a movie and start watching it, or does it involve online stuff too?
Both online and on cable. So Amazon,
where does it happen online?
Well, Amazon Instant Video, so not Amazon Prime, which is streaming.
Amazon Instant is just a rental?
Yes, you can pay $3.99 to get a rental, and you can watch it. You know, if you start playing it, you have 24 hours to finish it. You can watch it as many times as you want within 24 hours. You have 30 days to watch it. It's that kind of VOD.
So you're telling me most people, when they do a video on demand on cable or something, they pay $5 for it?
Well, it's like $3.99 now, $4.99. Yeah. I mean, and
well, he's saying it's going to go up a dollar to $6.
Correct.
That's the average, I assume. I mean, what else could it refer to? Does it mean the top price? I mean, there's no one cost, obviously, because different people charge different amounts.
Yeah, I'm not delving too deep here.
Well, how did he get $5? Where did that number come? That seems high to me.
It does seem
high. Like, you're
high
renting
to me.
A movie and you're going to pay $5 for it? That seems pretty high when every time you go to the drugstore, you pass a red box. Obviously, the selection is much greater, and video on demand, the window is different because you get stuff available video on demand at a different time frame than you do on DVD or in the theater and so on. But wow, I mean, what, $6 to rent a movie? I sure as heck wouldn't pay that. I mean, I guess
would
you
pay
$16?
Would you pay $16?
Well, exactly. Well, I mean, if you want to spend $6 to rent it, you'd probably be more likely, if you think it's worth it, I'd just wait till there's a movie I actually really think I want to see and pay $15 to own it.
That's right. And he's saying that this analyst, I think his name is Eric Wold, that's going to increase to $16. So $15 to $16.
No, he says it's going to be about unchanged, $15 to $16, depending on the movie. Okay. So that's digital downloads, electronic sell-through. But gee, I mean, you seem to be pushing people to buy it. If you're going to charge that much for video on demand, it seems that you're just trying to kill off your audience.
Well,
that just seems too much.
Well, I would tend to agree with you. Now, I did want to point out that Raul Buril, he contacted me via Facebook, and he said, just finished listening to this week's episode, another great episode. Just one note regarding Ultraviolet, and this was what we talked about last week, Michael.
Uh-huh.
Disney's been including UV codes, ultraviolet codes, with their discs since about last summer. Their last six or seven major releases have all included UV codes. That includes The Little Mermaid, Cars, The Great and Powerful Oz, Planes, Monsters University, Robin Hood, and...
Well, Monsters University is not Disney, is it? Oh, it is. It's Pixar.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mary Poppins. Unfortunately, they still don't participate in any disc-to-digital program. And I knew when I said that, I was thinking, well, I hope I got that right last week.
Oh, so what was it you were talking about? Studios that let you pay a fee in order to go
disc to digital. So, and
you mentioned Disney as being one of them.
Yes. Well,
it's a correction on you. Well, I enjoy it. Thanks for writing, Raul.
Well, no, I said that they didn't have any UV titles. And what I really was thinking about was that they don't participate in this ultraviolet disc.
Raul, write in any time you hear Sperling make a mistake.
And speaking of which, Raul actually has placed a number of stories and links to great stories on our Facebook page, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. If there is news you want us to cover, you can place it there, and we will put it in the show notes and cover it in the following week. So
sometimes we don't, you know, so many people send us a story like the one you mentioned up higher about the digital DVD sales and all that, you know, or we already saw it ourselves, so we don't always, you know, say, hey, thank you, Joe, for sending that to us, because 100 people sent it to us, or we already had it. But whenever a lot of people show interest in the story, that lets us know that you care about that and makes us more likely to cover it. So even if we don't name check it, we really do appreciate every time you do that.
That is true. Now, I am pretty sure that everybody would want us to cover the Golden Globes, because it wasn't really covered that well by mainstream media.
Yeah, I didn't watch it. I could care less. And on Thursday, the Oscar nominations can be out. Nobody will care. This has a shelf life of 48 hours.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a shelf life of 48 minutes, which is about as approximately how long I cared about it.
Well, that's okay. But well, then why are we discussing it? But anyway, Best Picture, 12 Years a Slave, and American Hustle for Best Comedy. Matthew McConaughey.
Which, by the way, I have to thank Leonardo DiCaprio, who won Best Actor for a comedy or musical. He got on stage and he said he'd like to thank the Hollywood Foreign Press for their veracity and their candidness. For, you know, he never thought he would ever win an award in a comedy category for being the best comedian. But you know, he felt honored to be nominated with other comedians like Bruce Dern and Christian Bale and Oscar Isaac and Joaquin Phoenix for Her.
Those were all best comedy performances?
Those were all nominated. Those were all performances nominated.
All the Bruce Dern character did have a lot of humor in it.
Yes, but it's kind of like...
Inside Llewyn Davis is kind of a stretch. So is Joaquin Phoenix for Her.
Right.
That's pretty much a drama.
Which is, he was making fun of them.
Yeah. Well, all right.
I mean, The Wolf of Wall Street is in that same category.
It's certainly a humorous movie. It certainly is meant to be over the top or whatever. You know, who cares about the categories? I mean, the fact that they actually recognize comedies would be nice if those weren't all dramas.
Right, exactly.
I guess is the main thing to say, since the Oscars tend to overlook comedies so often. So yeah, he won, Matthew McConaughey won, Cate Blanchett won for Blue Jasmine, Jennifer Lawrence won for American Hustle, and so on. The Golden Globes are actually a little bit better as far as television is concerned. Not that they predict Emmys, but they do help bring attention to shows that didn't get it necessarily from other award shows. They did it with Party of Five. They've done it with other shows. They've been there early on some really good shows. And this year, I'm not saying it's a great show, but it was interesting. Their big news for me was recognizing Brooklyn Nine-Nine as the best sitcom.
Yes, I was surprised at that myself. So was Andy Samberg, who won for
Best Actor for that show. Yeah
and
it's,
I think
it's his baby, and you know, Big Bang Theory, Girls, Modern Family, Parks and Recreation. I'm falling asleep just seeing those names on the list. So Brooklyn Nine-Nine, you know, good credit to them. It's not a great show, but it's a pretty good ensemble. And I like him. He's very appealing. And he's sort of funny. You know, I've watched it a couple times. I've dipped into it. I enjoy his character. And they're getting sort of a good rhythm. Maybe it'll become a great show at some point. I doubt it, because some supporting actors are kind of weak. But, you know, it's better than your average bear. And good credit to them for, you know, highlighting a show that most people are ignoring.
Yeah, and they also, they kind of spread out the awards. Alfonso Cuarón for Gravity for director, Spike Jonze, who also directed Her, wrote the screenplay, won the screenplay award there, over 12 Years a Slave and American Hustle and others.
Yeah, I mean, you could see any of these being the ones for the Oscar, but really it doesn't mean as much because none of these people vote. It's probably more telling who got nominated for a DGA than it is who won at the Golden Globes.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that what I thought, and I know you want to get onto the DGA awards, give me one beat here. And that is, as I was watching the show last night and laughing at Amy Poehler and Tina Fey, I could not remember her name for a second. I thought they did a good job of hosting. Jacqueline Bisset's speech was, I couldn't watch it. It was cringeworthy. But the one thing that I kept thinking the whole night was, wow, there are really a lot of great movies this year. Whereas some years you'd go, well, of course, Cate Blanchett, Blue Jasmine, there's nobody else against her that you could talk about. But this year, there are a lot of great performances, both male and female, a lot of great writing, both adapted and original, a lot of great films.
That doesn't help you win awards. Who gave the best speech?
Who gave the best speech? I thought Andy...
Did Matthew McConaughey do a really good job? Because, you know, he's trying to get some momentum going for the Oscars.
I don't think that his speech really helped him that much, quite honestly.
Maybe the HBO series True Detective will help him.
Maybe.
You know, being in a quality TV show, getting a lot of press and attention for that. You know, he's having such a comeback and doing it with... I mean, that's kind of amazing. You know, his film career heats up to a great degree, more than ever for him as far as, you know, credibility and respect is concerned. And suddenly he's also on a TV series. That's kind of crazy, but that's the world we live in.
Yeah, that actually should tell you exactly where TV stands. But now let me ask you this. Best foreign language film, and then we'll get onto the DGAs here. Best foreign language film, Blue is the Warmest Color was nominated, which is the big Cannes winner, the Palme d'Or winner. Lots of controversy around it. Three-hour lesbian movie is what it was referred to as...
Only by men like you.
Only by people who went to Cannes and could remember.
A three-hour relationship film.
Okay.
A three-hour romance.
Okay. The Great Beauty one, which is the Paolo Sorrentino Italian film, which was, I really enjoyed it. Also a Cannes entry. The Hunt, also a Cannes entry. The Past, also a Cannes entry. The only film that wasn't was The Wind Rises by Hayao Miyazaki. What did you think of The Great Beauty winning over Blue is the Warmest Color?
I don't think that it won over Blue is the Warmest Color. I don't know if that was in second place, but you know, he's had increasing international recognition. Isn't it a movie about older people?
Well, it's a movie.
It's kind of an ode to Italian cinema as well, right?
Yes, it's an ode to kind of eight and a half.
It's right up the Oscar alley. It's what those voters will love. They'll eat it up. It's just, you know, it's catnip for them. So if you were going to pick a movie set unseen to win, that would have been the one.
Okay. Well, and, you know, Bono and the Edge and U2 picked up another award. Yeah.
Who cares?
So the DGA, let's get to the DGA, he said, as he scrolls through 20 pages of notes to get to the DGA nominations.
Right. I mean, they've got the nominations announced. It's kind of like their Best Picture nomination. It both indicates who's a front runner for Best Director, but it also sort of shows the movies that are in the hunt for Best Picture, because these are the ones that directors are supporting, and they're a significant branch at the Academy. So the films, if you like, or the talent, is Gravity with Alfonso Cuarón, Captain Phillips with Paul Greengrass, 12 Years a Slave, Steve McQueen, American Hustle, David O. Russell, and The Wolf of Wall Street, Martin Scorsese. The numbers of surprises, none.
Well, what about
Spike? You can talk about movies that were not nominated, but so what? It's like none of these movies are a surprise that they're on the list, so you can't say you're surprised by anything that's off the list.
Well, in this case, it's not movies necessarily as much as filmmakers.
That's right. It's the same thing.
Okay. Well, the one omission I would say is Spike Jones.
It's not an omission. Who are you taking off the list?
Spike Jones. I would take Martin Scorsese off the list.
Well, this is not a good movie. Well, sure, that's your preference, but it's not a shock that Martin Scorsese and The Wolf of Wall Street got a nomination, is it?
No, it's not a surprise.
Yeah.
It's a little disappointing that Spike Jonze doing such a great job on her.
I would say 12 Years a Slave is the weakest.
Oh.
Then Gravity is the next weakest. Then, Wolf of Wall Street is almost probably as weak as Gravity. Captain Phillips is decent, and I haven't seen American Hustle. So, you know, but I loved her. But, you know, there's at least three movies here that I don't think much of. They're certainly not on my list of the best of the year.
Wow. Okay. So
why?
Michael Giltz doesn't like any of the Gravity. Come on. Gravity was a good movie. You didn't like
okay.
it.
It was okay. It's not on my best of the year list. It was okay. It was entertaining to watch once. I never want to see it again.
Really?
Why?
I would see that movie again.
Well, God bless you. But, I mean, it's a one-note movie, and it had a poor ending. It looks silly.
Well,
it was a silly ending. It was a one-note thing. And the one twist in the movie I saw the second they started doing it. And it was just a very straightforward thing. Captain Phillips was very straightforward, but there was a little better acting. It was a little more interesting, a little more nuanced. So that's why I think that's a decent movie. I think it's better than Gravity. I think All Is Lost with Robert Redford is probably a little bit better than Captain Phillips. That's a little more interesting film. You know, no dialogue virtually. That's a lot bolder than any of these films on this list. I'm not sure it'll be on my best of the year list. I'd really like to see it again because its ending confounded me in a number of ways, but I've talked to people about it, so I really want to see it again with all that in mind. But, you know, I mean, I didn't think 12 Years a Slave was good at all. I thought Gravity was, you know, it's okay. Popcorn movie, but it doesn't stick with me.
Really?
I'm not going to remember.
Wow.
Really? No, really, of course. You think I'm going to be thinking about Sandra Bullock's performance for years from now? Oh, the way she scrunched up her nose in that space moment.
No. I think that is a film that you'd have to say is a director's film.
Well, I don't think it's a good film, so I wouldn't say it's a director's film. If it's a good film, it's a good film.
Okay, well, let's move on. Documentary for DGA. Here's why I'm bringing this up, and we'll kind of do a drive-by on this. Cutie and the Boxer, The Square, The Act of Killing, Stories We Tell, and The Crash Reel. The reason I wanted to mention this is 2013 was such a good year for movies that even documentaries, it's hard to pick between these documentaries. They're all great movies. They're all great documentaries. Now,
you've seen all five of them? I don't know what The Crash Reel is about.
It's about a snowboarder and basically it's about, you know, an X Games person who he got injured. And
oh, okay.
Yeah. And Stories We Tell is
that's the Sarah Polley film.
Yes. The Act of Killing is the Indonesian film.
Yeah, I know what the others are about. I just didn't know what The Crash Reel was.
Okay, they're all really good films and well worth seeing. And it's just, you know, normally there's one or two where you're like, oh, those films are the, you know, front runners. Here, who knows?
Well, the winner is going to be Sarah Polley, but the Crash Reel is about the competition between two legends, Shaun White, who we all know, and Kevin Pierce.
Right.
So it's not about somebody having a terrible disaster or whatever. It's about their back and forth, you know, over the decades as they, you know, lead up to the Winter Olympics in Vancouver, trying to see who can become better and better. It's true that, as everybody knows, Kevin had a crash,
right?
You know, in doing the half pipe, but you know, it's not about, like, you know, some man overcoming the odds. It's about their whole lifelong rivalry, friendly rivalry, which is what defines those guys in that kind of world.
True.
Yeah. But I mean, The Square could certainly win. That's a film about the uprising in Iran, correct?
Not Iran. Egypt.
Oh, Egypt. I beg your pardon. Egypt. Yes, of course. I was thinking the Green Revolution, but no, it's Egypt. It's I know a friend who met the filmmakers when the movie was at. Was it at Sundance or where was it at?
I want to say it was at Sundance. Yeah.
But they met them, and that's that was a very exciting movie. And of course, The Act of Killing is probably the boldest film on the list. A bizarre movie. You know, which you have people involved in crimes against humanity reenacting their crimes in the context of a movie. It's completely bizarre. But somehow I feel for Oscar time that Stories We Tell is going to have the pull of Sarah Polley, an actress turned director making a documentary. She had a well-reviewed feature film and now a documentary. I think that they're going to be really, they love to reward actors who stretch their wings like that. They all want to think they can direct. So when someone does it well, they really like to embrace that.
I agree. The Oscars love a story. The Sarah Polley story and Stories We Tell, absolutely correct. And a well-reviewed feature film. Didn't Julie Christie get nominated for an Oscar for that role?
She certainly did. So, Away From Her, or what was it called?
Yeah, Away From Her.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, very talented filmmaker and actress.
And of course, we watched the Golden Globes on television, and you probably did it via cable or satellite, but someday soon, maybe you'll be able to do it over the air again.
Yes, this is something that you will hear. And I know a lot of our international listeners say, well, why do we care about this? What's the big deal? Well, a lot of international standards take their lead from the FCC. The FCC participates in that. And this is a big federal communications FCC battle here. You have the broadcasters who have to provide over-the-air transmissions. So if you have an antenna, you just stick it up in the air and you can get free TV for local channels. Cable channels like CNN and MTV and ESPN, of course, don't broadcast that way. They're solely
cable.
But
if you want a broadcast license to be a local channel for one of the networks, you have to broadcast it over the air.
Right, and there are certain requirements that come with that, including public service, and it's worth billions of dollars. That's why they, you know, none of these networks want to give up their over-the-air licenses and their broadcast licenses. And then along comes this company that Barry Diller is backing, called Aereo, and they say, look, we're going to put all these micro antennas all over the place, so every single subscriber that we have at $12 a month will have their own little tiny dime size, literally the size of a small dime, antenna that delivers the content from that antenna through the internet to their television and or their laptop and or their tablet or their phone.
So people who want to cut the cord and stop paying $130 or $40 for cable or satellite can subscribe for $12 a month and get their local public television stations. I mean, ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, and PBS. And they can, you know, pull together whatever they want from the internet, like Hulu and other areas like that.
Right. Now, what is the big deal here? Because effectively, what Aereo is doing should be considered semi-legal. I mean, they're basically extending the reach of the antenna. Since they have to, you know,
it's already over the air. They're just making it available to you in another way.
Right. Well, all these broadcasters, and as we saw with the Time Warner dispute with CBS, they receive a retransmission fee. So they get advertising dollars for advertising on their network, and then they go to Time Warner and Comcast and your cable and satellite providers and say, we want $4 a month or $2 a month per subscriber. Well, that equals billions of dollars.
Right, because no one's going to subscribe to Time Warner Cable if they can't get their basic networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox. And so that's why they got to pay money to the networks. But Aereo says, oh, we'll give you the networks and we don't have to pay them anything.
That's right.
And they say, wait a second, you're charging $12 a month to show our stuff. I'm like, sorry, you put it out over the air anyway. So they've gone through the court system and now it's gone all the way to the Supreme Court, which means they finally ruled not on the case, but on the fact that they will accept it. Which is kind of a victory for the networks anyway. There'd been some conflict in lower courts, but not a lot. Almost everybody ruled in favor of Barry Diller and Aereo, but the Supreme Court said yes, they would take the case, which means they'll hear it, you know, probably in October, and the ruling will come out in 2015.
Right. And even the appellate judge, who did not want to rule for Aereo, did so begrudgingly, saying, look, Aereo is using some antiquated loophole to get through this.
That's a loophole. There it is.
And there, yeah, I'm like, well, it's not really a loophole. It's pretty much the law. You know, it was written specifically for over the air. Now, the big thing the broadcasters are worried about, this is really what this all boils down to. If Aereo can do this by sticking a little antenna on a, you know, a light pole somewhere, and a whole mass of them, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of these little tiny antennas, and, you know, on rooftops, if they can do it, you know who else can do it? Satellite providers and cable providers. So they're really worried that effectively Time Warner Cable will say, guess what? We're not going to be taking your feed to our head end anymore. Instead, we're going to put all these little tiny antennas, one for every single family or household that has a subscription to us. And that's how we're going to deliver our local television stations from now on. We're not going to pay a retransmission fee. Goodbye.
So beyond the possibility that this might in some way affect arcane regulations that go into place around the world in your home territory, the fact is that the major networks fund their TV shows with a lot of this money, not just advertising, but the retransmission fee. It's a lot of money. And therefore, if you like American product and you watch American dramas and sitcoms and reality shows wherever you are around the world, well, that could be threatened to a degree if they suddenly lose billions of dollars in revenue.
And it's about $4 billion, they're saying, in retransmission fees that they would lose.
Right. So how that's spread out among all the networks and other people, but, you know, it gets broken down. That's a lot of money.
That's
so
right.
That means you got to scale back. You know, their pressure is to provide more and more programming, you know, 365 days a year. They can't have reruns in the summer. Nobody wants to watch a rerun ever of almost anything except maybe the biggest sitcom. So they need more programming than ever. And if they get cut back $1 billion, well, wow, that's going to really hurt the bottom line.
Yes. Well, at least for them, I think what would wind up happening is all of these broadcast networks would immediately become cable networks. They would immediately say, that's it. No more over the air. We're cable.
Just so they could keep their retransmission fee.
Yes, I believe that would be
the
case.
Or what it would be called, something different, but there you go. And maybe they wouldn't even become a cable channel at all, right? Why bother with cable? Why not just send it directly to the consumer like the WWE is doing?
That's right. I was going to say they could actually use the WWE as a test case. Now, I know it's, what is it, World
Wrestling Entertainment.
Entertainment. I was trying, because it used to be the WWF, right?
Right, but they admitted, hey, this is not a sport. This is entertainment. And that's why they changed their name.
Yeah, I guess it was Worldwide Wrestling Federation or something.
It's all rigged. So, you know, it's all staged. Not that it isn't dangerous. Not that it isn't very challenging physically. But it's scripted and staged. And that's why they changed their name to entertainment.
Hey, man, I saw The Wrestler. I saw that movie. I know what it's all about. I like Mickey Rourke in that.
All right. Tell us what's going on with the WWE.
Well, it has nothing to do with Mickey Rourke or that movie. But what they're doing is they have these pay-per-views. About one a month, and then they have the big WrestleMania, and they charge $50 to $70 for these. But instead, what they're doing is they're going to create their own OTT over the top, meaning over the top of the cable box, and they're going to basically have their own channel delivered via the internet for $9.99 a month.
So it's a website. Instead of going to a bunch of cable companies and saying, hey, we want to be a channel, we want to get carried in 100 million homes, we want you to pay us a certain amount per subscriber, and they have a big negotiation, instead of doing all that work, they're just saying, let's create a website, and then you can access our streaming service via the website.
Right, because they realize that the number of their fan base, they have a big fan base, and they know that instead of paying $70 for VOD and the pay-per-view, that they will probably pay $9.99 a month for access to this content, which is more than the 20 cents per cable or satellite subscriber they would have been paid by the MSOs, the multi-system operators, the cable operators. So they said, you know what? We spent $40 million developing a network that was going to be a cable network. Let's just make it an over-the-top online IPTV.
Now, do you think it's because they didn't have enough interest? Or they thought they could make more money this way.
I think it's the latter. I think they realized we have a very dedicated fan base that is willing to purchase most of the stuff we put out.
And so that's the ideal sort of group that you want if you're going to do something like this.
Right.
You want a hardcore fan base that's not huge, but, you know, not huge in terms of hundreds of millions, but is devoted enough to you to pay a monthly fee.
That's right. And
so, you know, like if you've got people who are fanatic about rugby and you can convince them to pay for your service, you're all right. Because, you know, rugby's never going to be a huge, huge channel on a, you know, it's never going to be a top priority for any cable channel. It would be a second-tier sports channel.
Which is why, right? they were going to be paid 20 cents per subscriber rather than the $3 to $4 that, say, ESPN gets or the, you know, MLB.
But if they had become a cable channel and they eventually pulled back the shows that they have on other networks, like USA Network airs Monday Night Raw,
right,
and Friday Night SmackDown, which is on the Sci-Fi channel, those are very popular shows. If those shows went out to this new cable channel, then they would be more popular.
Yes.
So, but those channels, those programs are staying where they are for the moment.
That's right.
And right now, this is going to be extra content, the big pay-per-view events, and presumably some other types of shows that will be available via this website. I think it's sort of confusing to call it a channel. It's a website. You got to subscribe to access the streaming video.
Right, and it's going to be available on Xbox and Roku and PlayStation. So there's more and more ways to reach audiences.
Well, that's really more to get it more easily to your television, right?
That's
anybody
right.
can access it. You just go online and pay your
yes.
money.
Yes, but right. who wants to sit at their computer and watch this stuff when you can watch it on your television? And it's much easier to do that now because of all these different devices in the home. Now, yep. as far back as what, like 2000, 1999, 2000, I was paying for Major League Baseball. MLB had, you know, all the broadcasts of games on the radio. Local, uh-huh. and I would pay for a yearly subscription to that. They then went and there was video that you could watch. And MLB,
what baseball team were you paying to follow?
The Mets and Yankees.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
And Major League Baseball did something very smart. We talked about it back when we interviewed Anita Elbersee, whose book Blockbuster talks about this. They created a whole different business called Major League Baseball Advanced Media, and it's all media. WWE, when they wanted to do this, guess who they went to?
They went to them for the back room.
That's right.
To support the streaming and having tens of millions of people log in and access their programming at the same time. They knew they needed big infrastructure, and so they went to baseball to use their backroom infrastructure to help launch their business.
That's right.
All right, so that's a pretty big deal for Major League Baseball, yet another client.
Hey, you know what? Since you just used two words, and I'm not talking about the word client or big client. I'm talking about the word big deal. It's probably time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, and I wrote about this on Celluloid Junkie, critic A.O. Scott of the New York Times loves the soundtrack to the movie Inside Llewyn Davis. Everyone knows it because he tweeted about it saying, "You all keep fighting about Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle. I'm going to listen to the Llewyn Davis album again. Fare thee well, my honeys." Producer Scott Rudin saw the tweet and asked Scott if he could use it in an ad and offered to remove the references to competing films. Scott said no, because he wanted to keep Twitter casual, and if he edited it, he would be manufacturing a quote for a movie. Rudin used it anyway. Scott seemed modestly miffed, and others wondered if the movie was breaking Twitter's terms of service, which says no one can use a tweet for commercial purposes without the original creator's permission. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, this is complicated. Number one, he didn't need to ask permission. Scott posted it for the public, for the world to see. If he wanted to quote it in an ad, he could.
That's right.
They do it all the time. I guess when you're a really top critic, sometimes they want to keep a good relationship with you and not, you know, distort your quote or whatever. And maybe they sometimes ask you, oh, can we use that for a quote? But I mean, when he reviews a movie or whatever, it's all fair game. You know, he can get angry if you pervert it and say, hey, take that. You removed the worst movie all the time and said the best, you know, something like that. But he didn't need his permission. So his mistake was asking for it, because once he asked for it and then to ignore him, that's just annoying.
I didn't know that Scott Rudin had asked for it. I did not think he had asked for it. I thought it was just they just used it without his permission.
Are you questioning the link in The Verge to the story?
No, I didn't read that column fully. So I would have to go back and read that. But I did not realize that, I guess is what I'm saying.
They were quoting the New York Times.
Okay.
Saying, according to the New York Times, A.O. Scott was approached by Rudin to use the tweet, edited down to avoid saying anything disparaging about the movie's competitors. Scott responded saying, well, this is a new one. I'd prefer, though, that my tweets not be used in advertisements. This is him to Scott Rudin. That seems like a slippery slope and contrary to the ad hoc and informal nature of the medium. And changing the tweet is basically manufacturing a quote, something I avoid. So I'm afraid the answer is no. Well, A.O. Scott is wrong, too. Changing the tweet is basically manufacturing a quote. No, it's not. Manufacturing a quote is when you haven't seen the movie and you, or you write something specifically. So here's your quote, your little, you know, they ask me all that all the time. Would you write a quote for our DVD? Will you watch it and write a quote? I'm like, no. If I review it, you can quote it. But saying that you edit out a reference to something or to something else negative is not manufacturing a quote. It's just making it legible and clear without slamming some other movie, which is not, you know, manufacturing a quote. It's just making it a clear and concise praise of this movie soundtrack. So I think A.O. Scott's wrong about that. Rudin made a mistake in asking his permission, which I think he clearly did. But I also think these people are idiots who say, oh, they're breaking Twitter's terms of service. No, they're not. Twitter can't tell you can't use it without anybody's permission. You can't post a quote for the entire world to see and then say, oh, you can't repeat it or use it in any way, shape, or form. Sure you can.
Well, you know, I found the whole thing interesting, especially in conjunction with, I guess, the following day, they ran an ad for Inside Llewyn Davis that thanked 400 writers, critics, and bloggers for naming Inside Llewyn Davis one of the top 10 films of the year. And I really loved what James Rocky said, is that he said the two-page ad repeating 400 humans praising film in New York Times may have cost more than combined salaries of said 400 praisers.
Yeah.
In any case, moving on. I know this is a topic you love, Michael, because capping off his historic run in late night, Jay Leno won his time slot for the, get this, 71st quarter in a row. Not just week.
Fire him! Fire him!
Not just week, but a quarter, a financial quarter. Now, this dates all the way back to 1995.
He's been winning for 18, 19 years.
Right.
Not counting, I guess, the time he was on retirement.
Now, he dominated in all key categories over Letterman and Kimmel, winning in total audience and all key demos. His fourth quarter ratings, an average 3.85 million viewers, is the highest in 3 years. That's amazing. Letterman had an average of 3 million viewers, and Kimmel an average of 2.6 million. The race for adults 18 to 49 is tighter, with Leno scoring a 0.9 rating, Kimmel a 0.7, and Letterman a 0.6. Jimmy Fallon scores a 0.6 as well in that demo, despite airing an hour later. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big head scratcher. Fire him! Fire him!
Yeah, I hate when people actually are doing a good job get canned.
As far as business is concerned.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, not as far as talent or anything like that.
Yes, correct. But in other words,
you can see where they're looking at the future. Kimmel moved to 11:30. I so dislike Kimmel as a talent that it clouded my judgment. Like, oh, that seems like a disastrous idea. Why push back Nightline when it's often winning its time slot? But you can see in the demos that they care about that Kimmel is already putting heat on Leno. You know, he's catching up. He's beating Letterman. He's, you know, catching up to Leno. He's very close in that key demo, which is where they make more money, and therefore advertisers pay more for it. So you can see where they're scared for the future, and they think Jimmy Fallon, wow, when he comes to 11:30, that's going to put even more heat on Leno, probably chip away at his lead there, if not eliminate it entirely. But, you know, we'll have to see what happens. But to me, it's, well, I'll talk about it. Leno won't be there when Fallon's there, of course. He's replacing Leno. So, you know, Fallon is beating Letterman even though he airs an hour later. So he thinks, oh boy, we're going to win, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know why Leno would be, why he would think, in any case.
Yeah. So it's just bizarre.
Well, let's move on then to writer James Michener, who is one of the best-selling authors of all time with some 75 million copies of his books in print. He also wrote big, fat doorstops of a novel. As a matter of fact, I have one of his novels as my doorstop. I think the Winds of War or...
No, that's Herman Woke.
I knew as I said, maybe I should stop the joke there because I'm about to say a title and I bet you I'm going to say it wrong. In any case, his works are heavy and people lugged them all around and actually read books like Hawaii and Centennial in Texas. So it was a big deal when Random House put out his novels in ebook editions because they're much lighter, of course, and they don't actually hold your door open. And they did that just a few months ago. Now they're reissuing his backlist in brand new trade paperback editions with new covers and new introductions, a standard way to keep authors and their valuable works in the public eye. First up is Tales of the South Pacific. Oh, I saw that musical. I really liked it. That's his Pulitzer Prize-winning collection of short stories and the source, a book set in the Holy Land. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop because it just shows such antiquated thinking. I mean, they're releasing these books now that they're going to cost like $16. You know, it just costs more than the book did when it first came out 40, 50 years ago. And it's just, it should have been bundled with an ebook. It should be cheaper. Maybe if you wanted to release it, maybe make a hardcover for $15 or $14. You know, that might attract somebody who wants to collect it and have a nice sort of thing to put on their shelf. There have been some reissues of like Ray Bradbury or Evelyn Waugh, where you've got, you know, nice, you know, smaller but nicely done hardcovers that are not full hardcover price. And they say, oh, well, it's been out for 30, 40 years. We want you to collect it and buy it again in a physical format. Maybe we'll make it a nice hardcover. But like a trade paperback edition for these books, 56, I mean, he has 26 novels. Tales of the South Pacific came out in 1947. The Source came out in 1965. For God's sakes, that's, you know, 58 years ago. It's almost 60 years ago for The Source. And they're going to put it out in an expensive trade paperback format without any thinking about what makes sense for today. To me, it just seems very wrongheaded.
Okay. I wish I had an opinion on this. I don't follow the publishing industry as well as you do.
Well, do you read?
This activity you're speaking of, is it legal? It is legal, right? You're not asking me if I'm doing something illegal because I don't want to admit to that. I'll take the fifth on that.
If you've got a book that's 800 pages long, how do you think you're likely to read it? You want to buy a big, fat trade paperback, or you think you're probably going to buy it on ebook?
I'd buy it on ebook.
Right, but say you like the author. I mean, these books are 60 years old, for God's sake.
I probably already own it.
Right. You probably already own it. So, like, but you can put it on trade paperback. Well, maybe a hardcover would appeal to you. Maybe you hadn't read it in a long time, or your battered paperback is on the shelf, or maybe you've lost it among moving. So maybe if it was a hardcover for $15, that might appeal to you. And what if it was a hardcover bundle with an ebook? You say, all right, I could read it again, have a nice thing to put on my shelf or something to make it more appealing. It just seems very nearsighted to me.
Well, unlike almost every other area of entertainment, theater producers love to boast when they've turned a profit, probably because it happens so rarely. That's the case for the starry revival of The Glass Menagerie starring Zachary Quinto and Cherry Jones. It opened in September and closes on February 23rd, but producers crowed that the show has just recouped its modest $2.6 million investment, which should tell you how long it takes to recoup your investment on Broadway, by the way. That leaves about 6 weeks for them to make some sort of profit. The UK production from Shakespeare's Globe of The Twelfth Night and Richard III in repertory also recouped this week. That gives them 1 month of shows to make a profit on its, what, $3.1 million budget before they close February 16th? Woohoo! Big deal or big what, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, this is the formula to a degree. You have big stars in a big revival of a well-known play. That's what they did with The Glass Menagerie. You know, that's how you make a profit on a play. That's how you don't lose your shirt. But no matter how much you do, when you've got big stars who can't stay in the show forever, you're so limited in, you know, how much money you can make. It's, you know, my God, why would you ever invest in anything but a musical and not without a big star in it? You know, just, you know, if you're lucky, you don't lose your shirt. That's the best you can hope for when you're talking about play revivals. Shakespeare's Globe production's a little different. It's a starry British import. It does have big theater names. Mark Rylance has become a really big name. Stephen Fry, perhaps, is a draw. But basically, it's the play is the thing here, and the prestige of Shakespeare's Globe is what brought people in. And again, if you're really lucky and the stars align, you won't lose your shirt, but you're going to make almost nothing. You know, there is no upside. All you can hope for is to not lose a lot of money, and that's kind of sad.
Speaking of Broadway, the Broadway League revealed its annual survey of the demographics of who is going to the theater. And who attends Broadway? Well, it ain't New Yorkers.
What?
Except for Michael, who lives in New York and still goes to theater.
That's true.
The core theater-going audience surrounding New York City provides key early word of mouth, but the hits survive thanks to tourists. That's right, tourists. While it's true the Broadway audience is overwhelmingly white and female, there are signs of diversification. In the 2012-2013 season, Hispanic and Latino ticket buyers soared to 8%. So it went up 8%. The highest...
No, it was 8% of total ticket buyers.
Ah, okay. So it soared to 8%.
Latino ticket buyers were 8% of the total ticket sales.
I see. Well, that's the highest since they began tracking, by the way. Thanks perhaps in part to two shows, Evita with Ricky Martin and Forever Tango. Tourists accounted for 2/3 of all tickets sold, while international tourists accounted for a record 1 in 4 of all ticket sales, or to be exact, 23%. The overall age dipped slightly to 42 years old thanks to a record high percentage of 18 to 24-year-olds, namely 14%, another record since the survey began in 1997. Is that enough numbers for you?
I knew you would love this piece.
Yes, I love it. In less positive news, here's some more numbers. 78% of theatergoers were white and 68% of them were women. I guess guys can go to Rock of Ages and Jersey Boys only so many times. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. I mean, it feels like the audience is basically the same. It's interesting to know it's all tourists, you know, overseas, America. It isn't New York and the suburbs that keep a show alive anymore. After the first 3 months, then it's all tourists. That's the rule of thumb in New York. They said the first 3 months is the local people, and after that, it's all the tourists. So if the show can get past that first 3 months and keep getting an audience, then they have a shot at a long run. But, you know, it's you know, there are some good signs of life as far as, you know, improving demographics. I mean, I guess there's a Tupac Shakur musical coming to Broadway in the summer. It's called Holler If You Hear Me. And it's not a biopic, but it's a musical using the songs of Tupac Shakur to tell an original story. I'm sure that will help the demographics and lower the age just a little bit come 2013, 2014.
Probably true. Now, the season premiere of Downton Abbey set records for a PBS drama and put it on a par with the red-hot ABC series Scandal. Both of them drew just over 10 million viewers in the overnights for the first episode in a new season. Downton did it despite the fact that the entire season has already aired in the United Kingdom, so the plot points and the storyline, that's out, and pirates who don't want to wait can see the entire thing just by, well, we won't tell you how to do it, but, you know, there are ways. It's up significantly from last season's premiere, so clearly there's no angry fallout from the 2012 Christmas special finale of the previous year.
A bloodbath. It was a bloodbath.
Yes. Well, now let's see what fans think about Sunday night's ugly episode 3. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, it continues to grow. That's a great sign for PBS and for the show. I actually have stopped watching after the episode of Sunday night. I'm done with it. The problem for me, I think, as I've said before, is that the acting's too good. It's a dumb soap, and it wouldn't matter if there were actors who were dumb, you know, or they knew they were on a dumb soap, and so they're having sort of fun. It wouldn't matter if 1 week I'm a nun, and the next week I'm a mother, and the next week I have an alien baby, and the next week I'm sleeping with my, you know, whatever. It's all silly, right? It doesn't matter in a soap. It's just all one crazy thing after another. But this show has really good actors on it, and it's really good production values, and so it actually feels like a cheat and annoying when they mess with you and do these stupid soap opera twists and turns. It gets very frustrating, and I don't enjoy it the way I might enjoy, say, Dallas or Melrose Place or whatever. So I found last night very ugly. I know the rest of the season settles down a bit and isn't so annoying as last night was, but I found the episode very unpleasant, and I just didn't want to deal with it anymore.
Ooh la la. The French have decided Miley Cyrus and Britney Spears, which in French they pronounce those names Miley Cyrus and Britney Spears, are too hot for daytime. To be exact, a French governmental body ruled that the latest videos from Cyrus and Spears, quote, may offend the sensibilities of the young, end quote, and should not be aired on TV before 10 p.m. Don't they mean the videos might offend the sensibilities of the parents of the young? I think that's probably more what they mean. And is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
The classic big whoop. Videos not shown until 10 p.m. in France. Oh, well.
Don't you mean Le Grand Whoop?
Perhaps I do.
Shia LaBeouf
We apologize to the people of France. And we love your country and the Cannes Film Festival.
Don't you mean Le Festival de Cannes?
Du film. Yeah. Oui.
Shia LaBeouf continues to taunt and otherwise play with the mini scandal surrounding his plagiarism of various works.
And I called it a mini scandal just because most of the world doesn't seem to be glommed onto this, and I don't think it's going to hurt his career, but there will be lawsuits of some sort of something. I mean, he's going to have to pay something. It's not that I don't take it seriously. It's that I don't think it's really gotten a lot of traction in the mainstream world.
No, although I would agree with that to the point where Jim Carrey came out last night on the Golden Globes, and
he made a lot of Shia LaBeouf joke?
Yes, he did.
And it was, nobody got it.
Well, it was kind of this weird inside joke. And yeah. He said, comedy is harder than death is. Anybody can die, but, you know, comedy is harder than death, basically.
Unless you're Shia LaBeouf.
And he said, I think it was Shia LaBeouf who said that.
That's very funny.
It is very funny if you know the backstory.
Okay.
And so it was an inside chuckle, but I think it fell so flat because so few people were following.
Yeah, I'm sure people at home had almost no idea unless they listened to Showbiz Sandbox, which you can subscribe to on iTunes.
That's right. And I think that you know, it was, I can't remember who said that. I want to say it was Laurence Olivier said, you know,
dying is easy, comedy is hard. I don't know.
Thank you. Yes, that is exactly what the quote is. And he said, I think it was Shia LaBeouf who said that.
Well, continue with the story. What happened?
Well, first, LaBeouf for years has been ripping off other artists. When caught out, he apologized by plagiarizing the apologies of others. Then he defended his actions in terms of quote-unquote art, saying copyright and other rules were bogus. Look at Andy Warhol, for Pete's sake. Then he hired a plane to skywrite an apology to graphic novelist Daniel Clovis. And now he's claiming to retire from public life, whatever that means, since he hasn't even deactivated his Twitter account yet. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. I think he's been very flippant about the whole thing. You know, he's been very defensive. And he's like, oh, he had this long email exchange with a guy on a website who had interviewed him before, talking about, oh, this whole idea of copyright is just malarkey, and it keeps artists from actually creating work, and we're all just sitting around a campfire retelling stories. And he's like, well, yeah, but you just took the guy's stuff and repeated and pretended it was you. You know, it's like, it's not exactly this tale of Odysseus that we're doing here. Like, this guy created something and you just copied it. So he's been very defensive, been very weird, very flippant, and I think this is more part of his flippant attitude. I don't think it's anything serious. I think it's just sort of a joke. And we'll have to see what's going on with him. But, you know, who knows if he'll ever actually pay a price. But it was Edmund Kean, the actor, who reportedly, allegedly said on his deathbed, you know, that dying is easy, comedy is hard.
Okay, so I just misattributed a quote to Laurence Olivier. What I find interesting about this, on a serious note, is that Mr. LaBeouf has just starred in that Lars von Trier movie.
Uh-huh.
Nymphomaniac. And
right.
Lars von Trier has retired from public life, so maybe it's catching. Maybe it's contagious.
Oh, yeah. Lars von Trier has not retired.
Okay. Well, that kind of wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And, of course, this week, we're talking about the Consumer Electronics Show and 4K. We talked a little bit about 4K last week. 4K being...
It's a new television screen standard, right? Is that how you would talk about it?
Yeah, it's like Ultra HD is what they're referring to it as. It's, I guess, if 1080p or 1K, if you will, is
high def.
Is high def. 4K is four times the, you know, four times greater. And
it's the next new excuse to buy a new television.
Yes.
Okay.
But now, as Dan Rayburn over at the Streaming Media Blog has pointed out, there is a dirty little secret about 4K streaming, and that is that the content owners, so basically the CNNs, the YouTube, well, I'm sure Google can afford to do this, but certain content owners who have to get this content from their servers to your television set or your computer or your mobile device, they can't afford to push 4K content.
And, but wouldn't it be the cable companies, your provider, that would be paying for it? It wouldn't be like CNN. It would be Time Warner Cable.
Well, here's the thing. When you are a content provider, you have a host facility, whether that be Amazon's web services or Rackspace. Somewhere out there, you have...
CNN?
Yes. Everybody has their own CDN, which is a content distribution network. And they have to pay for hosting, so the servers at that facility, as well as the bandwidth, the content going in and out of that facility. The more popular you are, the more bandwidth you need, the more expensive.
So they have that between themselves and a cable provider? So they send it via that those servers to Time Warner Cable, and then Time Warner Cable sends it to you?
Right.
I mean, they're not obviously putting it right into your home unless they have a website or whatever, but as far as you watch TV on Time Warner Cable, you're saying they have to pay a lot of money to get it to Time Warner Cable, and then Time Warner Cable has to pay a lot of money because it's a much bigger file because there's more information on it. It's like, you know, the difference between downloading a digital song and a digital movie.
Well, right?
Right.
And that's Time Warner Cable and Comcast and all these okay. networks to the home. Their big problem is they're considered dumb pipes. All they are is a pipe. And so they have to manage the water, and in this case, the data, flowing through those pipes. Mm-hmm. And so really, let's leave Time Warner and Comcast out of it for just a second.
Okay.
Because let's talk about getting from the server out onto the internet. Right now, you know...
Now we're talking about websites.
Now we're talking... Yeah, these are all websites. These are all kind of internet
You're talking about if you access CNN.com as opposed to watching it on cable TV.
If you access CNN.com and watch a 4K video.
Yeah.
Okay. Right now, and this is going to put some real numbers behind it, and Dan Rayburn did this. Okay, so right now, CNN and others are delivering video to you today at 3 megabits per second.
This is high def.
That's high def, and that's kind of what you'd see also if you were to, you know, turn on cable TV and watch CNN. You're probably getting something at 3 megabits per second. To give you some, I don't know, a perspective, over-the-air transmissions usually come in at between 15 and 18 megabits per second, which is why so many people say that over-the-air transmissions are actually better than cable or satellite. But again, putting that aside, 1 hour of video at 3 megabits per second is going to be about 1.4 gigabytes leaving a server at CNN or ESPN or wherever it is and coming into your home onto your Roku or your laptop.
Okay.
So if you're paying about 2 cents per gigabyte, which is a low price, it's currently costing CNN about 3 cents to deliver 1 hour of video to one person. If they then want to deliver...
But surely it comes in bulk or whatever now? Or...
Well, yeah, but that's why
right.
It's so...
So you're saying you're watching high def right now. They're paying 3 cents an hour just to give you that video. If you watch a whole hour on CNN.com or an hour of YouTube, it's costing them 3 cents just to send it to you.
Correct.
In that's bandwidth. A very rough estimate. Right today in high def.
Right. Now, if you're going to do 4K and get this, that kind of quality...
That's going to quadruple the cost.
Right. 11 cents, and it would cost 18 cents, depending on which bitrate you use. But again, I'm trying to make this simple.
So it's going to cost a lot more to switch it to 4K. And for their websites, that's a lot. What is it? Can we even talk about what it means for cable companies?
Well, the cable companies are on switched video, and the pipe is really...
It's their own pipe, so they don't pay for it.
Right.
But here's my question. You're talking about the cost of CNN.
Let me actually, not to interrupt you, but I did want to say it costs not the cable company, because, of course, what it costs them is they have to manage the traffic flow, so there's more data to manage, but their pipes are pretty much big enough. The problem that they're going to have, and it's actually a problem for consumers, is that there are data caps, 250 gigabytes per...
Oh, right. That's what I was getting to.
Right. So you want to watch a 4K movie? There's 2 gigabytes per hour.
Right, and you're already getting dialed down by your people who provides your data connection.
Right.
Say, oh, you're watching too much. Well, that you're going to blow through whatever standards they have in like 5 minutes. Or if you're watching on your tablet, and you have a monthly amount that you have set aside, right, for downloading or for looking at stuff,
right,
you're going to blow through that, right?
Correct.
You can go blow through it four times as fast.
Right, that is correct.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm already worried about buying a new tablet and getting one with an actual connection so I don't have to wait for a Wi-Fi signal. I want to do that. But I'm worried about the cost of what it's going to do to me. Like, well, when I'm just downloading, I don't even download movies or things onto my tablet. If I'm just watching something or playing on websites, I'm worried about hitting that data cap. If I actually go to YouTube and watch a video and it's going to be four times as much, you know, because it's 4K, I don't even care about it that much. But suddenly I'm burning through my data cap really quick.
Well, and so the point here for Dan Rayburn is that, and he's right, is that the technical feasibility of this, it's there. You can do this. You can deliver 4K to the home.
Of course.
Totally there. The business...
Just like we could have delivered movies for years, but it took too long to do, and so it wasn't feasible.
Right.
Now we're saying, okay, it can happen, it can happen quickly, but it's going to cost everybody a lot more money. Everybody meaning the web hoster, CNN or Yahoo or YouTube, and the receiver who's going to blow through their data cap really quick.
Precisely. And so the issue there is more of a business case.
Now who's thinking about this? Is anybody saying, is CNN saying, well, wait a second, maybe I don't want to do this for CNN.com because that's just going to screw me and my consumers over?
Oh, yeah, they're definitely thinking about it because it matters in the way they encode their video. So they're encoding it at a much lower bit rate because they have to push all this data through to you, and they...
So are they saying something like, okay, we'll develop 4K, maybe 8K for over-the-air broadcast, meaning the channel that we put out on CNN on the TV, but for our website, we're going to stick with this lower video standard. We're
right,
going to not
correct.
Dial it up.
Correct. Absolutely.
Because right? Otherwise, it's just going to be a nightmare for everybody.
Right. And just to be clear, Rayburn isn't saying that HEVC, which is this encoding standard and technology, or VP9, the codec an encoding standard that we talked about last week. He's not saying that it's not going to take off. What he's saying is really that it won't, 4K won't be this motivator for the technology, at least for a couple of years.
Well, it sounds like 8K will be even worse for us.
8K would, yeah. I mean, yeah. Absolutely.
Right. So they don't have the pipes big enough to handle it. We'd have to pay a lot more just to watch it, and we're going to get angry, and CNN's going to have all this increased cost to offer what? Slightly better video?
Precisely. Which brings us, by the way, to our listener email. Dirt@showbizsandbox is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. Our email comes from James Gardner, and it's fairly technical and a little...
Oh, my God. Please put it in English.
Okay. So last week...
I couldn't understand it, James. I'm too dumb.
So last week we talked about VP9, which is this codec, this way of compressing raw video, like the video we take on our cameras, be it a DSLR or video cameras, compressing it down so that it can be delivered over the internet.
It's like you compress audio into MP3. That's a standard for audio right now.
Correct. Now, H.264 and H.265, that is the standard used to encode iTunes. For the most part, that is offered by a group called MPEG LA. They are the patent holders, and you have to pay them just like you have to pay Fraunhofer for MP3. You have to pay, not you, but the people who make encoding software.
And last week we talked about Google trying to establish an open source standard so that people wouldn't have to pay them to do that. They wanted to develop their own standard called VP9 as a way of getting around having to pay that patent right to those people. Now, here's an open source one. Everybody use this. It's better. You won't have to pay for it.
Right. And James wrote in to say, and I'm going to skip ahead here. He's been doing a lot of encoding. He's been encoding for a long time. And he says, it's always interesting to see what codecs will be coming in the future. And he says, Google appears to be using VP9, this new codec, as a keep them honest play against MPEG LA, the group that owns the iTunes and the H.265 encoding codec. So that said, he went on to say, in terms of it being better, VP9 being better than H.265, what iTunes is using, he would tend to doubt it. He goes on to explain why, that there have been several tests and, you know, it hasn't scored as well. Again, I think what Google was saying was it's more efficient, meaning it gets to people out of the data center and onto their laptops or computers or television screens in a more efficient manner, not necessarily better. What James says, at the end of the day, it's not about best, but good enough. Another point to make is that greater than 2K for domestic is arguably not needed. There is a tendency for media types, like yourselves, to always push for better. No one clicks on or listens to a news post saying it's all going to stay the same. I feel we are not going to get the traction the TV makers want. People are not going to buy new screens when they cannot see a difference under typical viewing conditions. It's similar to the high-definition CD audio at 96 kilohertz, 24-bit. So right now, just to give you a sense, all CDs are like 16-bit, 44 kilohertz. So that's twice, you know, it's going up. Let's put it that way. It does exist. That is these high definition CDs. They do exist, and you can get such recordings. But the public could not hear the difference, and it never really got any traction. If 4K gets any traction this year or next, it will probably be because consumers can only purchase 4K screens going forward. In real terms, there is very little reason to spend all the extra money for 4K over 2K distribution. 4K in production is a different story, of course. Regards, James Gardner, Digital, Melbourne, Australia.
Well, a lot to say here. First of all, thanks a lot for writing. He had a fascinating aside that he said that the people who test how these different standards work are often from Russian universities, which I was like, what? And Sperling, you explained it to me.
Well, in the Russian universities are doing academic studies, and so they create these what are called white papers, which are unbiased, you know, they're not
like the Consumer Reports.
Yes, of a specific subject matter. Whereas here in the United States and a lot of European testing labs, they're doing it for profit. They want to make some money on these reports that they publish.
And so they are sort of the standard worldwide as far as, you know, unbiased analysis of, well, how does this work? How well does it work? And they're saying, when you look at it, the Google one isn't, not only is it not better, but it's probably not as good because it may be quicker to get the information to you, but it's a little more garbled. So it's kind of like, okay, we'll get you that download of that movie quicker, but it's going to look like a VHS tape.
Right.
It's not that bad, I'm sure. Google be angry if they said that. But that's the gist of what they were saying. But I found it fascinating that the Russian universities were the ones that were, you know, sort of the worldwide experts in this area. It's kind of interesting.
Right.
And the other thing I wanted to say was, gee, I don't know if we push for things to always be better, meaning higher standards, new standards. I think if anything, we always try to voice a word of caution. We're like, 3D TVs? No, people don't need them. They don't want them. Here are the reasons why. And in fact, when they say TV 3D sales are growing, like he says, it's only because those are the only ones that are available. You know, people buy a new TV set, it's going to be 3D capable. And therefore they say, oh, look at all the homes with 3D capable TVs. Yeah, but they're not using it. And I think he's absolutely right. Their 4K sales will increase this year, but people are not dying and begging and pleading for 4K television. They're just buying, you know, they're ready to buy a new TV and that's the one that's available. So as 8K comes along, you know, prices will come down and 8K will be the one, but it won't gain widespread acceptance unless the programming is there, people really see a difference and are willing to pay the price, or if it's just a natural upgrade. Like if you buy a DVD player now, you're buying a Blu-ray player.
Right.
It's going to be backward compatible, but you're paying $80 for a Blu-ray player. Why would you buy just a DVD player? I don't even know if they make them. They probably do, but basically you're buying a new thing to play a disc. It's going to play Blu-rays and DVDs. That's just where the world is now. So it's not that people suddenly said, oh, I want to pay a lot of extra money for my movies and I love Blu-rays. It's just the one that's left.
That is absolutely correct. And I think James is absolutely right in saying the traction will come from, you know, if you're a television manufacturer at this point, why would you make a 2K television?
Right.
Except for cost.
It's not a sign of people dying to get 4K. It's just that's what's available. And that's one that's at the decent price point.
So at the end of 2015, if the only television set you can find on the market is a 4K television, don't be surprised. And thus, don't be surprised if 4K takes off, not because people are watching 4K, but because instead they have no other choice.
Well, there's a 4K base in people's homes.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Kind of like there was with HD. A lot of people had no idea they had HD televisions.
Yeah.
So, but in any case, James, thank you for writing. Of course, you can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. You can call us 888-567-SAND. That's our voicemail number. That's 888-567-7263. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to email us or call us. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our username. We're also on Facebook. You can like us, search for Showbiz Sandbox. Please do subscribe to the show on iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, wherever they give podcasts out for free. And if you're so kind as to review us, we'd greatly appreciate it on any one of those podcast aggregators. Again, showbizsandbox.com is the place to find all of that information. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com, and, as I just learned, also at Coachella this year. Michael Giltz has a website. This week, Michael Giltz's website is...
whereslabouf.com.
Oh my goodness. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's writing about entertainment news on whereslabouf.com, try bookfilter.com or the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.